the exact same structure that prior administrations exploited, and we need to put an end to that right now because Utah deserves better.
Thank you, Mr. Stormont. The Attorney General, please.
Thank you, and thank you to the Utah Debate Commission and BYU for organizing this event. A special thanks to my wife, Sasha, and our six kids. I am the luckiest man on earth. And Aiden, I'm sorry, buddy, it won't be at football practice tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, I am humbled and honored to serve as your Attorney General. I'm proud to lead the 240 lawyers and 200 other professionals in our office. They inspire me every day. And because I make a difference each and every day, a positive difference in the lives of Utahns, this is the greatest job that I've ever had. 9 months ago, I inherited an office racked with scandal and controversy. I've worked hard to bring back integrity, credibility, and a commitment to excellence. Every day, I run into people across the state who thank me and my team, whether they agree with me on all issues or not. They thank us for returning honor to the office and focusing it on being a law office that they can be proud of. These are average citizens, but they're also lawyers and judges. They're also leaders in business, and that's why the governor and lieutenant governor and legislators from both sides of the aisle and local leaders from around the state have given me their support. I'd like to tell you some of the reasons why morale in the office has gone from an all-time low to sky high in just 9 months. Because I went to the legislature to get funding for compensation that we haven't had, raises that we haven't had for 12 years in our office, and staffing to meet critical needs and technology to bring us into the 21st century. We asked all leadership to resign and encouraged everyone who felt qualified to apply. Not because of any affirmative action program, but because when you widen the pool and promote on merit, you get better results. And we've increased women in leadership from a percentage in the 20s to 40% now, and have gone from zero minorities to a handful in leadership. I got calls from concerned Republicans saying, "What are you doing promoting Democrats?" My response is, "I don't care if there's an R or D next to their name. I promote the best." When we started, our clients were also extremely dissatisfied, and the state auditor just released a report that only 6% of them are now dissatisfied, and 31% of them are more satisfied now than 9 months ago. Those are the types of results that the state needs, and that's what we will continue to build upon.
Thank you both. The Utah Debate Commission has established a format that allows each candidate 90 seconds for an initial response to question posed by a panel of four journalists and a bit later by citizens. We're going to go to a question from our panel of journalists, and the first question will be from Richard Pyatt. Mr. Pyatt.
Thank you, Professor. Good evening, gentlemen. I'm excited to be here among the panelists talking about the laws and interfaces with the way of life here in Utah, and I'd like to start with the differing opinions on the issue of polygamy in this state. As you know, polygamy is rarely prosecuted here unless it's associated with a very serious crime in conjunction with the practice itself. It's technically illegal and rarely prosecuted. My question to you is, should it be prosecuted? And if it's not prosecuted, should it still be illegal?
And this one goes first to Mr. Stormont.
Thank you very much. I was in St. George a couple of weeks ago and met with a number of healthcare professionals, and they tell me that they see regularly women and children who are the victims of domestic violence and rape, and they're incredibly concerned that these victims of crime have nowhere to turn. These victims in polygamous communities have nowhere to turn within their own communities in law enforcement. The question of polygamy right now, we have a tremendous sideshow. We're appealing the bigamy, criminalization of bigamy in Utah. It's a tremendous sideshow with a reality TV star, and we have tools that we could use to help members of the polygamous community. I believe it's a tremendous waste of time. It's a tremendous distraction because, as you pointed out, we don't prosecute bigamy charges in Utah. Sean has not brought a single case since he's been in office. We haven't filed a single standalone bigamy charge since the mid-1940s, and we haven't brought one in conjunction with other charges since the mid-1990s. This is an area where instead of chasing headlines, we need to use the tools that we have. We need to use the domestic violence laws. We need to make sure that we're stopping rape, that we're pursuing welfare and tax fraud on the ground with real resources instead of pursuing sideshows and headlines.
Mr. Reyes, your response to Mr. Pyatt's question.
Thank you. Thanks, Richard. My polygamy policy will continue to focus investigations and prosecutions on predators like Warren Jeffs, who our office prosecuted, who engage in unauthorized activity with minors, and on those who also engage in economic crimes like tax and benefit fraud. With regard to the United Effort Plan Trust, the state should not have been in the position of trying to manage a private trust to begin with. And when I was in court recently on this case, I made that argument to the judge that it's time to return that trust back to the beneficiaries. She agreed with me, and we're closer now than any time before to having the beneficiaries run that trust, with the state providing services, human services, law enforcement, and education. The other good news is I've worked closely with the sheriffs and county attorneys in southern Utah, and my team at the Attorney General's office has won back trust from the fiduciaries, from the beneficiaries working with the fiduciary. We have helped the fiduciary start to disseminate trust property, which was the whole purpose in the first place of getting involved. We've helped build a public school that is uniting disparate elements of the community, and we've coordinated training, resources, and support to those who've been disenfranchised from the FLDS Church, including the Lost Boys. In terms of the Brown case, a portion of Utah's anti-bigamy statute was struck down, and we have filed a notice of appeal and plan to appeal on substantive and procedural grounds.
Mr. Pyatt, a follow-up first for Mr. Stormont.
So, Mr. Stormont, are you saying that the practice of polygamy should not be illegal because the state's not prosecuting it by itself, not in conjunction with another more serious violation?
I believe that's not quite the right way to put it. It should not be prosecuted because it's already been held to be unconstitutional. And the concerns that we have that arise out of polygamous communities, we have other tools and resources available to address those concerns. We have domestic violence laws. We have rape laws. We have tax and welfare laws. We need to actually start putting resources into those instead of wasting money on appeals that have a very slim chance of success when we have real problems that need to be addressed. We need to use the tools we have to address those real problems.
And Mr. Pyatt, a follow-up for Attorney General Reyes.
Mr. Reyes, you pledge to continue to prosecute these serious crimes. I guess the same question to you. Should the practice of polygamy, should the state back off of that? Should we only concentrate on those other more serious crimes?
No, I think I made that point that we'll emphasize the other ones, but we don't abandon those. Those are the laws on the books, and we defend those laws until they're proven to be unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court or the laws are changed. And again, as far as prosecutions, they're very difficult in that community. Polygamy prosecutions are difficult without willing witnesses, and we have worked hand-in-hand with Arizona and the Department of Justice and have made great efforts. They just had a victory on the other side of the Twin Cities on anti-discrimination laws, and we worked hand-in-hand with them. We've supported decertification of law enforcement that is controlled by the FLDS Church. And so we're continuing to work as much as we can and put as many resources as we can to helping curtail the most serious and egregious aspects of that community.
I'd remind both candidates to be aware of the time, if you could, please. Let's go to the next question. It's from our media panel, Rod Decker.
Will you defend Utah's laws and constitutional provision against same-sex marriage? How wholeheartedly, how vigorously, how expensively?
This question goes first to the Attorney General, Mr. Reyes.
You know, Rod, the Kitchen and Evans cases raise very important and deeply personal issues, and it's why I said from the beginning that we need to take it to this United States Supreme Court, because that will benefit all citizens getting a clear and final answer. Even the plaintiffs in Kitchen agree with me that they want a clear and final answer, and they deserve it. But until we get that clear and final answer from the Supreme Court, it is my duty to defend the laws that the people of Utah have passed either through their representatives or through a constitutional amendment. That is the oath that I took to support, obey, and defend all of the laws. Now, I understand that my opponent and Eric Holder may have a different view of these things. They say that you can pick and choose which laws you want to defend based on your political or your personal views. They say that even before the Supreme Court rules, you can substitute your own guess for what is constitutional or not and abdicate your duty to defend the law. I say, Rod, that you can't cut and run. You can't thwart the democratic process because you think that you're smarter than the Supreme Court. Windsor didn't decide this case. That's why we're taking it to the Supreme Court now. And if my opponent would take off his political glasses for a moment and put on his lawyer lenses or his leader lenses, he would realize how dangerous that precedent is that he's proposing. He's proposing that the AG have a litigation veto. And that will undermine the credibility of the Attorney General's office in the long run.
Mr. Decker for Mr. Stormont. Same question?
Same question.
All right.
Thank you. I think it's incredibly important that we start actually serving as a legal advisor. That's what a legal advisor does. You tell your clients what their likelihood of success is going to be in court. It's time to actually start giving good, honest, fair legal advice to the people of Utah. We haven't had that for a very, very long time. We've had far too much political advice on hot-button issues. The Attorney General is supposed to be a check and a balance on abuse of powers by the other branches of government in Utah. That's how it's set up in our Constitution. That's why the Attorney General has an affirmative duty to challenge unconstitutional laws. And I've been accused of picking and choosing which laws to defend, but I think it's important, again, that we're honest with the people of Utah. When we pick to throw hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars at a variety of lawsuits on hot-button issues, we choose to ignore real crises in the office. We choose to ignore our Child Protection Division, many of whom have double the recommended caseload. Instead of 60 cases, they have 120 cases. In some instances, as recently as a year ago, they had 180 cases. We choose to ignore our criminal appeals section, who are swimming. They handle every single criminal appeal in the state of Utah. They are swimming in cases, and they have a hard time keeping up. We need to make it clear that when we pick one law and throw money at it, knowing that we're going to lose, we choose to ignore children who are in abusive situations, and we choose to ignore the lawyers who are trying to help keep convicted criminals in jail. And I think it's important that as a legal advisor, you share all of that information with your clients and with the people of Utah.
Mr. Decker, a follow-up for Attorney General Reyes.
Is there any law that you can imagine that you would say, I won't defend? It's unconstitutional. Anything the legislature does, you're their lawyer and you go forward?
Sorry, Rod, I'm just going to respond to that because it's interesting he brings up child protection and criminal appeals. I'd like to ask Charles if he knows which attorney general was the one who went to the legislature to get more criminal appeals lawyers and child protection lawyers. That was me. And it's interesting that he talks about politics because his proposal is the most political of all. Here's the deal. If you want to make policy, Rod, you run for the legislature. If you want a veto power, you run for governor. But if you want, and if you're running for attorney general, you better be ready to defend all of the laws, whether you agree with them or not, or whether they're politically convenient or not. And that's my response.
Are there any other laws that you would refuse to defend? Are there a bunch, or is there just this one?
I think the line is a very clear one. It's a constitutional line. When a law is constitutional, you absolutely have to defend it. But when the legislature and the governor or even the people cross that line, we don't get to legislate people's rights. And the attorney general, again, is supposed to be a check on these abuses of power. So if you have the ability to go into court and stand up for a law on constitutional grounds, you absolutely should. But when you cross a line and you create an unconstitutional law, it's time for the AG to stand up and defend the people's rights and not the machinery of government.
The Utah Debate Commission encouraged Utahns to submit questions for tonight's debate and for the other debates in this series. The website is utahdebatecommission.org, and we invite you to submit questions for future debates. One of those questions came in from Eileen Campbell in Logan. This one will go to Mr. Stormont first. With as many as 450 employees in the Attorney General's office, pay raises and bonuses can be a sensitive issue. How do you plan to evaluate employee performance? And what are the criteria you would use for determining pay raises and bonuses in your office?
One of the reasons I came to work for the people of Utah 6 years ago, it was not because of money. It was not because of the salary, because the AG's office is way behind the market when it comes to salaries and bonuses. What we have in place right now is a system that's not really being enforced, a system of evaluation, a system of progression, and a fairly rigorous set pay scale. One of the problems that we also have with the $1 million that was recently secured is we've set a tremendous amount of that aside for bonuses. People don't come to work for the people. People don't come to work for the state because they're interested in a bonus. They come because they want to serve. That's why I came to the state. And I think instead of putting money away and setting it aside as a way to curry favor with employees, as a carrot that you can dangle in front of them to try and encourage them to behave a particular way, if there are genuine issues that need to be addressed, they should be addressed. We don't incentivize and disincentivize. We need to go forward, address the real problems, and serve the people. Serve the people the way we came to work. That's what we come to do. That's why we do it. And instead of holding money back the way prior administrations have done, We should make sure that we're serving other resources. Instead of hiring only one criminal appeals lawyer, we should hire several. with the $400,000 or $500,000 we have set aside for bonuses. I think bonuses are an area that are really dangerous in the public sector.
Mr. Reyes, your response to Ms. Campbell's question.
Thank you. I think the thrust of the question was about performance evaluations and how you would assess the bonuses and other issues. You know, when we came to the office, we were shocked to find that there were no performance evaluations. There were goals and plans and aspirations, and those weren't even enforced. So how can you properly assess, either to promote or give bonuses or to discipline, in an office that large without such structure like that? So we have implemented a performance evaluation system. Now, we're rolling that out through our 16 divisions and 50 sections, but that is something that was a priority for us. Now, the money that we went out, I'll never apologize for that, because while people may not come to the office because they're looking for riches, they do deserve to be treated like professionals. And for 12 years, they were promised raises and never got them. And when I got to the office, that was the number one issue, and morale was so low because of that. And we had lost so much of our top talent. Now, we still have wonderful lawyers there. And I would agree with my opponent that they're not there primarily for the money. But when they can't make ends meet, not just lawyers, but paralegals and staff, then that was a crisis for us. And that's why we made it our number one priority. But we just didn't want to distribute the money all across the board. We wanted to give everybody a lift. And I promised the legislature I'd be responsible about this. We would allocate money to the superstars, people who give up weeks and weeks and weeks, and last year may have gotten an extra $100 bonus. Well, now they can get a $2,000 bonus as determined by their leadership at the local level, at the division or section level. Thank you.
The rules established by the Utah Debate Commission allow me the opportunity to ask a follow-up question or to invite the candidates to do a rebuttal. In this case, you know more about this office than I do, so I'm going to invite you to do a rebuttal. We'll go with Mr. Stormont first and then Mr. Reyes. 30 seconds, please.
And I would applaud Sean on the performance evaluation implementation. I think that's a great idea, and it's something that we do desperately need. I think, again, though, there's a bit of a difference in how we would manage when it comes to bonuses and how you incentivize behavior. You incentivize by finding people who are interested in serving the public. If you've got somebody who's giving up weeks and weeks and weeks of their time, it means that we don't have resources properly allocated within the office, and that highlights an area that we need to focus on and reevaluate.
Mr. Reyes.
No, I think that's true. When we got there, there were probably 20 different areas that I inherited in triage mode. And so you only have a finite amount of resources, and the legislature only gives you a finite amount of money to work with. So we targeted ones like criminal appeals and like child protection that needed it the most. We really want to incentivize our superstars to stay in the office. And I've won back and recruited back a number of folks from other agencies. I like to say I'm an equal opportunity poacher, because I'm going to bring them back no matter what, if they can help our office win. But you need to be able to be competitive, and you need to show the people who work hard that you're willing to stand behind them with compensation and bonuses.
The next question comes from the Utah Debate Commission. It is, child abuse and child pornography are a growing problem in Utah. As a state, are we doing enough to protect our children? What steps would you take beyond what is currently being done to address this issue? This goes to the Attorney General first.
Sure. Child protection, particularly when it comes to pornography, has been one of my priorities. My three priorities have been focusing on violent crimes, drugs, and protecting children from internet predators. You know, we also have white-collar crimes that we're focused on, and protecting our state from federal overreach. As to the child pornography issue, it's an epidemic. And we have worked with NGOs and with other agencies. In fact, I have expanded under my administration partners in the ICAC, Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. And so now we've broadened our reach. Our ICAC program has historically been very, very talented, and I've added additional resources in manpower and materials to the ICAC program so that we can continue to be the envy of the nation when it comes to stamping out predators on the internet. So I'm proud of what we've accomplished in a short 9 months. We're continuing to prosecute and investigate. We have implemented technology that helps us root out and find who these evildoers are, these predators, including those who would human traffic in addition to engaging in child pornography. So those issues have been at the forefront of my administration. And if you ask any of those who work on our criminal side or the investigators, they're feeling much better now about the leadership and the direction and the resources that they have. I just went out with them recently to do an undercover sting operation where we shut down a number of massage parlors because they were engaging in that kind of sexual conduct.
Mr. Stormont, your answer to the question about child abuse and pornography prosecution.
And again, I would applaud Sean and his efforts with respect to the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force. They're doing an incredible job, and I think that's an important area that we need to continue to provide resources to. One area that I think is not getting enough attention, and we've talked about it briefly already, is in our Child Protection Division. Again, when children are in abusive situations, they need help. They need help from the Department of Child and Family Services, and the AG's office is a backup in the legal system and the legal process that we go through. Because that area is so overwhelmed right now, we have 34 child protection attorneys at last count that I saw. If that's changed, I'd be curious to know. But those 34 attorneys are swimming. What they could do if they weren't swimming and if they had a more reasonable caseload is they could go out and serve as a resource for police officers, for prosecutors, for social workers, provide the expertise when it comes to interviewing children. That is an area of expertise that not every rural community has at its ready. And we need to provide those resources to law enforcement across the state. And we have experts in the office that could do it if we could get them a more reasonable caseload, allow them to take a step back and start addressing problems at the get-go so that criminals who are caught are convicted, so that we can marshal those cases through the system properly and effectively. And I think that's one area where we could really focus in a lot better.
Let me ask a follow-up of both of you. This is an area in the law where federalism is alive and well. The federal government is also interested in these issues, and the U.S. Department of Justice and the U.S. Attorney and others also pursue sting operations and so forth. Would you tell us, please, how you intend your office to work in collaboration with federal authorities on child pornography and sexual abuse?
Sure, we already do. One of the first things I did, Professor Magleby, was sit down with our federal law enforcement partners. For a long time, had felt disenfranchised and unwilling to work with us because of territorial disputes or the AG's office's unwillingness to reach out. And so we have already reestablished a great working relationship with DOJ, with the FBI, and a number of different law enforcement agencies, not just at the federal level, but at the county, state, and city levels as well. Our sheriffs and our chiefs are solidly behind me because they understand that I'm serious. I'm not the top cop because I'm not a cop, but we will be there with them and give them every resource that they need to succeed. I have done this, though. I've expanded children's justice centers in that milieu, and that's a critical part of what the AG's office does to protect children from abuse. Thank you.
Mr. Stormont, and if we need to, we'll add a little time.
No, I don't think I have a great deal to add. I think the way Sean describes it is very appropriate. We need to go out and we need to work corroboratively, with law enforcement on the federal side, with prosecutors on the federal side. We certainly should not be drawing circles and saying this is my playground and this is your playground and don't cross those lines. I think a more cooperative arrangement is very appropriate, and it's something I look forward to building upon.
Thank you. As we reach the midpoint of our time tonight in this debate, I welcome you once again to go to UtahDebateCommission.org and send in any questions. We are here on the campus of Brigham Young University in Provo, Utah. The debate is part of a series of five live televised debates for Utah's four congressional seats and for the Office of Attorney General. A bipartisan group of citizens, media outlets, and universities have joined together to provide you, the voters, a chance to learn more about the positions of the candidates. It's a remarkable thing that we're seeing here tonight, unprecedented in Utah history. Tonight's questions are, as I've said, drawn from four respected journalists and from those who submitted them to the Utah Debate Commission website. Thank you. We invite you to be part of the process and provide questions that you would like to see taken at a future debate. Also, the website has the schedule for future debates and will provide an opportunity for you to watch completed debates on demand. We'll go now to some more questions from our respected panel of journalists. And this one will be from Don Hudson. It will go to Attorney General Reyes first. Mr. Hudson.
Thank you very much. You know, some groups estimate 50,000 Utah children have had their Social Security number, identity compromised. It'll be hard to pinpoint that number, but we do know thousands of Utah employers have admitted that they are paying wages to Social Security numbers that do not belong to their employee, but actually belong to Utah children. Credit to the AG's office in the past year. You've handled 65 cases like this, prosecuted 44 cases. You also have people assigned to the issue. You also have the IRIS program to register your child's identification and Social Security number, which is a great tool to fight against identity theft. My question is, because I have done stories, other media outlets have done stories with families who had this happen to their children, and until it does, nobody seems to really know what's even going on or care. How do you plan to increase prosecution, speed up prosecution, and have better prosecution so that we can protect Utah's children?
This will go to Mr. Stormont first. I misspoke.
Oh, excuse me. Okay. That's a great question, and I'm not sure if you're aware that the IRIS system also exists for parents to report potential identity theft issues for their children. It's a great system, and it provides a beginning point. But you're right, on the prosecution side, there's more that we could do. And I think when it comes to identity theft, whether it's adult or children or anybody, right, there's an opportunity out there right now that I think we really need to start pursuing within the Attorney General's office. What I would like to see happen in the identity theft area is we start to pursue a public-private partnership. So a little about me, my wife not too long ago got a phone call from our credit card company, and somebody in Salt Lake City was attempting to buy a tremendous amount of electronics. The credit card company caught it. My question is, if they can pick up the phone and call me or call my wife and say, there's a serious problem here, is this you? We're confirming it. Why can't they also call law enforcement in? Why can't they bring law enforcement in when they have the person attempting to make the purchase? And I think there's a tremendous opportunity. We have data centers here with Discover Card, with American Express in Utah, where we can do this. A lot of these crimes are cross-border, and that presents a tremendous obstacle to prosecution. But if we have an opportunity to create a public-private partnership, we can actually begin to hold people accountable, make this a crime that has real teeth so that we discourage the crime in the first place.
Attorney General.
Don, just to flesh out the gravity of the issue, I totally agree with you. I think U.S. Postal Inspector says it's the fastest growing crime in America right now, and some call it the perfect crime because these are children, many who, before they're even born, have their identity stolen, and parents aren't running credit transactions on them for a number of years. I worked, even before I came to this office, this was such an important issue for me, with a woman named Jennifer Andrushko, who we sent to Congress to testify about the seriousness of this. She had a 5-year-old son whose identity was stolen, and she didn't find out until she made application for some federal benefits. So your question, what do we do? I'd love for you to read the statistics again for what we've done this year as far as prosecutions. Let me just paint it out a little bit more. Under my administration, investigating and shutting down ID mills has been one of the focuses of our secure strike force. Now, they do human trafficking and many other things, but we shut one down just last week, and I want to share with you some numbers. We shut down around 40 per year. You said in 2013, we had 23 prosecutions with 67 mill investigations, multiple parties with each mill. And this year, in only 9 months, we've doubled the prosecutions, and we have already a similar amount, 65 instead of 67 investigations. That shows you how committed I am to that issue of protecting Utah's children on the identity theft fraud. Now, we're moving away. We had a partner, TransUnion. We're still working with them on the IRIS program. But I fought with the legislature to get budget to keep IRIS so that we could continue to protect on the front end children who can register with the state to have their identities protected.
Mr. Hudson, a follow-up first for Mr. Stormont.
We've heard about all the ID breaches, especially with credit cards. You've had some of the retailers, big retailers. Moving that aside and getting more specific about Utah children and Utah people, when we know, and the Attorney General's office is aware, we know that child X's number is being used by person X up at Park City or wherever they are working, and we know that. Again, what needs to change to go after that person and say, hey, you got to stop using their card and be prosecuted? Do we need to change the laws? Do we need harsher laws? What is going to finally stop the thousands of people who are using our children's Social Security numbers to go to work?
Mr. Stormont.
I think this is an area where the AG, who has an eye on so many different, right, we serve as the legal counsel to the entirety of the executive branch, so hundreds of committees and agencies. This is an area where we could see that our tax commission has access to these numbers and could highlight a problem. But the tax commission right now is very isolated from the secure strike force, so they don't have the ability to walk across the aisle, and there are some privacy concerns in the law. We do need to work on identifying areas like that where we can tweak the law so that the folks who see it in the first instance can walk across the aisle, and actually in our office it's in a totally different building, but share that information and see that prosecutions can actually be started.
Attorney General, the same follow-up.
Well, I think we're making great strides already, Don. So not to fight the premise, but you know, we get hundreds of complaints. We work closely with our county partners. They mostly prosecute that cases. We do some of the higher risk cases. But on that front, I think we're being very aggressive. Are there laws that would help? I would like to see laws that toughen up the penalties for people there. And you're also talking about a whole host of other issues that come into play regarding immigration and regarding security and regarding a number of other internet and technological issues. But I would support legislation to crack down and have higher penalties for people who ruin other people's lives, especially children's lives, unfairly.
Let's go now to Max Roth. This one will first go to the Attorney General, Mr. Roth.
Okay. Thank you, Professor. And thanks to both of you. I'm sure you'd agree with me that what happened with your predecessor and your predecessors means that the public needs to look at running for this office with increased scrutiny because of what happened with money in their campaigns. I brought visual aids with me. I'm sure you've been curious as to these beads in front of me. I was looking at both of your campaign finances this morning, and then I stole some of my son's Airsoft BBs in order to demonstrate something that I saw.
Do we have somebody we could send after him for this?
Yeah, there you go.
About the,
he may file a complaint. He'll knock on your door
tomorrow. As long as you're not mailing them right now.
Yeah. So, Mr. Reyes, I don't know if you know, but you have a total of 86 donations in your entire campaign from January through August. 86. Those 86 donors gave a total of $284,000. Mr. Stormont, you have a total of 466 donors or donations to your campaign. Those donations add up to $81,000. It's a gigantic difference. And I wonder if you could tell the audience, Mr. Reyes first, why they shouldn't believe that you owe a very few people a whole lot at the end of this campaign.
I think it's a fair question, Max, and obviously given the circumstances of our predecessors, the public is very interested in that. I've taken very important measures to insulate the Attorney General's office from the influence of special interests and unscrupulous contributors. The first thing I did was to separate the legal side of the office from the campaign side, so two entirely different staffs, and no more will there be people on the campaign side with contributions influencing who gets prosecuted or who gets a pass on the law side. Now, my team carefully scrutinizes on the campaign side every single donation or potential donation, and we've turned down a number of them from businesses and from individuals from various industries. We've worked closely with the Lieutenant Governor's Office to report and improve reporting and disclosure requirements. I don't take donations from anyone that our office is prosecuting. Before accepting or rejecting donations, we have consulted with a number of advisors, including people like the chair of the governor's bipartisan commission on tasked with recommending proper election and campaign reform. Regardless of who's contributing, though, Max, this is what I've emphasized with them. While I'm appreciative of the donation, it doesn't buy them any special treatment. And while there may have been a for sale sign before on the door of the Attorney General's office, not my words, but those of the investigators from the legislature, there's a new sign since I've been there, and it says, "Beware of the dog." One reason is because I've been working like one, 80-hour weeks. And the second is because I'm a bulldog when it comes to protecting the integrity of my office.
I need to remind you of time, please.
Citizens from corruption, abuse, and crime.
Question for Mr. Stormont, and we'll add 15 seconds to the answer, please.
Why shouldn't voters look at this many people giving this little, and think, well, you have a lot of friends, but you're not very effective?
Not very effective. That's an interesting question, because I think the number of contributors shows that people really do believe in the message that we are taking around the state, that we're going to bring real ethics reform, we're going to bring a more collaborative office environment. And I think the number shows that when people can't write a $10,000 or a $20,000 or a $100,000 check, such as the donors to my opponent have done, they're going to dig deep and they're going to give what they can. It's not a question of effectiveness. It's a question of buy-in from the public and from the people, from real people. I do have a small confession to make. I do have one large donor. It was my aunt. She gave $10,000. And I did make one promise to her, that we would come see her at Thanksgiving. I'm pretty sure that's something we would have done anyway. But I do think it's an interesting way of putting that question, because I'm incredibly proud of the way that we've raised money in this race. We've outraised the prior Democratic candidate. We're working very hard. We just began our radio spots. We're getting ready to buy TV spots as well. We're working very hard at building a strong, effective campaign. And I guess I would push back on the effectiveness. I think the numbers there show that we're being incredibly effective at hitting the ground and talking to voters.
Mr. Roth, a follow-up question quickly for each of them?
Yes, and this same question for both of you. You've both gotten money from some very powerful attorneys. A lot of law firms advertise that they have former attorneys general on their staffs who will help companies avoid prosecution from attorneys general. I wonder if you would both promise, when you're done with your office, that you will not take a job that advertises that you, as a former attorney general, will work for the people you're telling all of us you're going to fight right now.
Am I first?
Yes.
Yes.
I'll give you that promise right now, Max. And I also want to say the majority of our donations, if you go back and look, are actually under $1,000. So the majority of our smaller donations, and we're proud of that, the good people would like to give and make sacrifices for somebody that they trust. One comment, though. If you take the $100,000 donation from RAGA, which is the Republican Attorneys General, and there's a Democrat Attorneys General organization, we work together collaboratively on a lot of bipartisan issues. And if my opponent hasn't received a contribution from DAGA, then I would say that speaks more about the campaign than about the organization itself. So, you know, RAGA and who we've raised from, we're careful, we've vetted them, and I'm proud of our donations.
Mr. Stormont.
I believe that it's interesting. I haven't reached out to the Democratic AGs Association because I don't know who their donors are, and I don't want to take dark money. We've seen what happens in the very recent past when that happens. And I haven't reached out to them very, very purposefully. It's an intentional thing that I have done. I think on campaign finance, there's an opportunity for the people to study those numbers and look at them and give a good hard look at them and ask if you have concerns, then we need to talk about those.
Just a reminder to our viewers, you're welcome to submit questions for future debates at utahdebatecommission.org. This next question will go to Mr. Stormont. It's related to the last question. Do you feel campaign finance laws in Utah should be stricter? Utah is one of only four states in the United States with no limits on contributions, either as to source or amount. You both mentioned $100,000 and larger contributions. Those would be illegal in many states. If so, if you think they should be stricter, what would you suggest for reform to the legislature and why? Your office has been the subject of the greatest abuse in this campaign finance area. First, Mr. Stormont.
I think we've heard a little bit about personal choice somehow influencing what the AG does, and I think it's important for people to understand the AG is not a policymaker. The AG is a legal advisor. As a legal advisor, I don't have the power or authority to implement or impose campaign finance restrictions on other candidates. I do believe it's an area where candidates can stand up and make a clear stand on where they're coming from. I've made a clear stand that I won't take money from payday lenders. I won't take money from multi-level marketers. I won't take money from biz op firms, alarm system companies, cable companies. And the reason is these industries, although many of them operate perfectly legally, many of them receive thousands and thousands of complaints at the Department of Commerce. The AG is charged with assisting in those investigations, investigating those complaints. Given that charge, we need to be able to take a good, hard, objective look. So it's a place where, as the Attorney General, you don't have the ability to pass a law and impose those restrictions, but you do have the ability as an individual candidate to stand up and show how you're different.
Mr. Reyes.
Sure. I was supportive of the stricter campaign laws and disclosure laws that we just passed this last session. I've worked closely, again, with members of, including Kirk Jowers, the chair of the governor's bipartisan commission on strengthening Utah democracy. We've talked about a number of the different ideas that they have, and I would be supportive of looking at various campaign finance reform. I do want to say, too, though, that we don't and haven't targeted specific industries to decline contributions from. I think that sends a bad message. I think it stigmatizes unfairly certain industries. I think the better and more healthy solution is to make sure that you're looking at every single potential donation that comes in, because they're good and bad actors in every industry, and you don't want to paint with a broad brush. I think my opponent at one point said he wouldn't take donations from those who come under the purview of the Attorney General's office. And if you use that rationale, everybody in the state and every business comes under the purview of the Attorney General's office. So theoretically, you know, none of the contributors that have donated to his office would be allowed to make contributions there. So I think you have to be really careful before you call out businesses or industries when you are the state's top law enforcement officer.
Let me ask a follow-up, because I don't think either of you really answered my question. I want to know whether you would propose legislation or encourage legislation. I realize you're not legislators, to limit campaign contributions to statewide offices, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general in Utah. Set it at $50,000, set it at $100,000. Right now it's unlimited, and as you know, the attorney general office and other statewide offices have received donations in larger amounts than that in the recent past. First, Mr. Stormont.
Again, recognizing the importance here of drawing the line between legal advisor and policymakers, as a citizen of this state, I would absolutely advocate for much stricter contribution limits or actually having contribution limits in the first place in Utah. I think $50,000 is way too high. I don't see how anybody can take that much money and not raise questions about what influence it buys. It needs to be lower. It needs to be below even $10,000 if you ask me.
Mr. Reyes,
as a citizen.
Attorney General Reyes.
And to answer your question, then, yes, I would be supportive of some limits. I don't have a specific limit in mind.
Good. Let's go to the next question, again, vetted by the Utah Debate Commission. This will go first to the Attorney General. As you reflect on the recent reported wrongdoing by two former attorneys general in Utah, what do you see as explanations for a state previously known for clean government having such large problems in public integrity and the use of prosecutorial discretion? Was it greed, a quest for more power, what? And how will you change the culture in the office? Attorney General Reyes.
You know, I'm not going to respond to all of those. Actually, could you repeat the question? Because it seemed pretty multifaceted, and there were parts of it that I thought were fair, and others because of ongoing cases and prosecutions.
Sure, we don't want you to get in the way of any ongoing prosecution. So I said reported wrongdoing that involves in a state previously known for clean government. How could such a previously known state have such large problems with what I'm calling public integrity and the use of prosecutorial discretion? What explained it?
I'm not going to speculate on the motives or alleged motives of my predecessors, but I will say that I think I'm pushing the office in the right direction. And let me tell you some of the things that we're doing that I think might address some of the issues that you're raising. We have an internal ethics committee that I helped restructure. We have a civil service review commission. It's an external ethics committee that looks at wrongdoing at the city, county, municipal level. If those things elevate up, I've created a public corruption unit to look at wrongdoing, not just in our office, but externally. And we have now an actual investigative unit specifically to go after and prosecute public corruption. Now, internally in our office, I don't think whistleblowers have ever been more protected, because I understand the importance of whistleblowing, and I understand how much that helped in the last helped bring to light some of the issues that you talked about. So we are creating an internal affairs structure that if people have issues, even with management, that they can stand up and make those complaints without worries of or retaliation or repercussions. There are laws that protect whistleblowers also, but we've been working on this since I came into office to find the right structure to protect the people in the office and also protect the public. That's as far as I want to go in speculating as to how it happened.
Good. Let's go to Mr. Stormont on this question.
Thank you. First, I realize I didn't answer Max's question, and it touches on the same subject. Yes, I do promise not to take a job from one of those firms. Getting into what prior administrations and prior AGs, what's in another person's heart, I can't, just like Sean, I can't speculate on that, and I'm not going to. But I do have a clear path, a clear plan to rebuild confidence. Right now in the AG's office, we have a serious problem. We count on the integrity of one person, and we've seen with prior administrations what that system can bring us. We shouldn't have to wait for the other shoe to drop. We shouldn't have to wait for the next corrupt AG to show up and take advantage of that system. We have folks who are incredibly isolated in the work that they do. There's no collaboration. The right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. People ask me, you work in the AG's office. What did you know and when did you know it? I was in a different building from where some of these problems were going on. And instead of giving people a place where they can speak up, the Attorney General has put a gag order on employees of the office. He said, if you speak up to the press or to anybody else without my permission, you'll be fired. I want to create a state ethics office to give people a voice and give them a place to turn when they see corruption. I want to create a more collaborative environment so that on every case we have at least two attorneys, so that on every case if somebody tries to come in and exploit or take advantage of an attorney, there are two voices to speak up or more, so that we increase the number of voices, we increase the structural protections to ensure that this can never happen again.
Let's go to another question rather than a follow-up in the interest of getting more questions asked. This one again vetted by the Debate Commission. What state's Office of Attorney General do you see as a model office for Utah as you work to regain public trust in your office? And why do you hold that office in such high regard? Mr. Stormont.
Gosh, that's a hard question. I would say that I actually look to the Utah Constitution and the model that it sets up. The AG is supposed to serve as a legal advisor, and then I fall back on my own experience as a legal advisor and as a public servant. Those are the cores that I'm bringing into this this discussion and into this race, that I want to see politics come out of the office and that we restore the office to an office that's guided by public service, that's guided by the law, where politics has no place. Those are the core principles that I want to bring forward to the Attorney General's office.
Mr. Reyes.
You know, I've sat down and worked with the AGs across the United States, and we've gleaned from them a number of best practices. So Democrat states, Republican states, Hawaii, Washington, I've taken some of the best practices from there. We have friends from the national organizations that have come in and helped give us advice. Oklahoma, South Carolina, a number of them have things that we've adopted, and there are things that they've adopted from us. Just on a side note, though, as far as a gag order that it was referred to, that's a nice soundbite. It's highly inaccurate. The only gagging that goes on is when the lawyers in our office hear my opponent use that term because they know it's not true. The only one who's gagging is if you're disseminating information that you shouldn't be, private, confidential, protected information. And we have a policy in our office that is consistent with most agencies and all law offices that I know.
I want to thank you both for your brief answers to that question. We get one more question, but it'll be even briefer, 30 seconds. What do you anticipate will be the most pressing legal question or issue which the public will look to the Attorney General's office for leadership? Attorney General Reyes.
It still is, and is restoring trust back into the Office of Attorney General. I've done that in a short 9 months, bringing integrity back, focusing it on law first and foremost. And then after that, it's protecting Utahns from violent crimes, protecting them from white-collar crimes, which we've done a great job of. Utahns have never been safer from Ponzi scammers and schemers and bad business practices than under my administration, and also from federal overreach and overregulation. Those still remain the three things that we're focused on because I think
okay.
All of them are
let's
significant.
Go, let's go to Mr. Stormont. 30 seconds, please.
And I agree that that bringing real ethics back into the office is an incredibly important step, bringing real structural change to the office so that we don't operate with the same system that prior administrations were able to exploit, the same system that still leaves those opportunities in place. Fortunately, right now with Sean, I'm confident we don't have somebody who's going to exploit them, but I'm concerned that the people don't have that confidence and they're worried about the future. I want to bring real structural change to the office so that we can rebuild confidence with the people of the great state of Utah.
Thank you both. We've reached the end of our time for questions and now move to one-minute closing statements. Prior to airtime, it was determined that Mr. Stormont would have the first response. Mr. Stormont.
Thank you, Professor. The Utah Constitution establishes the Attorney General's office as an independent voice, part of the checks and balances that are built into our system of government. But for too long, the Attorney General's office has been something else. For too long, we've had attorneys general who are very good at saying the right thing, but who consistently do the wrong thing. As your Attorney General, I will get to work doing the right thing. I will create a state ethics office and make sure that the people of Utah can once again have confidence that the Attorney General is on their side. I've learned in my life that we need opposition in all things. That is something that the Attorney General can bring into our system of government. That's why I'm asking for your support, so that we can get the AG's office back on track. And I want to say thank you to Sean for being here tonight. Thank you, Professor Bagleby and KBYU, for hosting. I'm sorry, this is an incredibly emotional moment for me. I'm just so excited to be a part of this process. Thank you so much.
Mr. Stormont, thank you. Attorney General Reyes.
Thank you. While I grew up in humble circumstances, my immigrant parents taught me the importance of self-reliance, hard work, family, and community service, and that's what I've built my life and career upon. After graduating summa cum laude from BYU here and Berkeley Law, I made partner at the largest law firm in the state of Utah, where I spent years in federal and state courts winning cases across this nation on behalf of Utah citizens and Utah businesses. During that time, I was recognized as the top young lawyer in the nation for my legal skills, leadership, and integrity. The experience that I've gained in 17 years leading large teams of lawyers and statewide organizations makes me the best candidate. And what Utah needs now is a leader. I am a bit disappointed in my opponent that he's attempted to go so negative with ads that take things out of context. I've seen those tactics before against the last person that I ran against. I think it says something about how he may lead. Utah needs a real leader right now, not someone who only talks about leadership or who wants to lead lawyers for the first time in his career. Utah needs somebody who has spent an entire career leading lawyers to victory time and time again, somebody who is leading now and somebody who will continue to lead. Thank you and God bless you.
Thank you. My thanks to Attorney General Sean Reyes and Mr. Charles Stormont for their participation this evening. On behalf of the Utah Debate Commission and you, the citizens, I express appreciation to Brigham Young University for hosting tonight's debate. Please join me in applauding the candidates.
Underwriting for KPCW is provided by Tesh Law Offices, exclusive on-air sponsor of local election coverage. For 25 years, Tesh Law has provided legal answers concentrating in business, real estate, construction, and government law at 314 Main Street, 649-0077 or teshlaw.com.